From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in February 2017 when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued discrimination charges against all of the major Hollywood studios. According to the EEOC, the studios systematically discriminate against female directors. The charges came 7 years, by the way, after Kathryn Bigelow won Best Director for Hurt Locker. Bigelow is the only woman who is a director to ever win that award, and she is one of only five total who have been nominated over the Academy's 90-year history. At film schools, research shows, though, that roughly 50% of students in grad programs for directing are women. So it's not like women don't want to get into this field. Where is the crack in the pipeline? Where are all the female directors? That question is at the center of a new documentary called Half the Picture. It will be screened at the Little Theater tomorrow and Saturday as part of the One Take documentary series. This hour, we are joined by local filmmakers who are going to share some of the challenges they faced and overcome in the film industry. And we're going to talk about their ideas for how to bring more women's voices into films. And I want to start by welcoming one of our guests who is the director and producer of Half the Picture, Amy Adrian. Amy, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also back with us is Tam Little, the director and producer of MOVE. Tam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Linda Maroney is a filmmaker and director and programmer for the One Take Film Festival. Linda, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much, Evan.
And Clara Riedlinger, easy for me to say, is a filmmaker. Welcome back to you, dear. Thanks for being
here. Thank you.
All right, so I kind of want to start with Amy on why now, only because you could have done this any point in history. There's always apparently been, at least from the Academy's perspective, or this winnowing of what happens from film school down to who gets the jobs. This story could have been told at any time. What sparked the interest right now?
It's true. I mean, this has been an issue that's been ongoing since actually early Hollywood, there were a lot of women directors. But when it became more prestigious and there was more money involved, women kind of got pushed out. But for many decades, certainly this has been an issue of women not getting those opportunities. And it was kind of a few different things came together. I mean, one is I'm a woman director, and it was a period in my life where I was really trying to get my own work made and was having a lot of challenges getting my work financed. And so I had my own personal questions, like, am I trying to do something that isn't impossible, basically? And also, you know, in 2015, things did started to change in that the ACLU took on a year and a half long investigation into systemic discrimination in the hiring of women directors. Women directors have been saying for years and years that they're not getting the opportunities that they should be getting, that they're not getting in the door, that, you know, that it's just the system is not fair. And finally, the ACLU said, yeah, you know, it's illegal to only hire white men to be waiters or bank tellers or movie directors. And so when they came into this fight, it kind of legitimized complaints and issues that women directors have been talking about for a long time. So it seemed like not only were these issues there, but there were powerful forces that were, coming to the aid of women and legitimizing their concerns. And I wanted to document that process.
I mean, Hollywood's had all kinds of issues. And Linda, I want to ask you your take on some of the numbers I'm seeing. Before we do that, tomorrow, 7 p.m. is our chance not just to see the film, which you can do tomorrow at 7 p.m. or Saturday at 3, but also participate in a post-screening discussion?
Absolutely, with Amy. It'll be at 7 o'clock. I'm not sure about tickets, how many are left, so if people want them, they might want to scoop them up pretty quickly, though.
Okay, and then your second chance to see it is this coming Saturday.
At 3 o'clock.
At 3 o'clock. And so let me just read a few more statistics, and then I want to kind of get your take here. I'm looking at film schools, as we mentioned. Roughly 50% of the students in grad programs for directing are women. At the Sundance Film Festival, that number drops to 20% of the films made by women. And among the top Hollywood films, grossing films, only 4.2% of directors are women. So over the last 10 years, the top grossing films had a total of 1,114 directors, 45 female. And that's been the case, again, for decades. It hasn't really moved. So Hollywood talks this game about representation.
They do.
But it doesn't really happen.
No, nothing has changed as dramatically as we wanted or hoped or thought that it would by this point, unfortunately. I think there's been you know, more inroads in places where their budgets are lower and not Hollywood movies, be it independent film, be it documentaries or independent narratives, animation. Women, you know, can get their hands on being an editor in other places where there's not as the money isn't as lucrative. And that's been sort of a longstanding thing, unfortunately. I worked, you know, for an animator called Faith Hubley when I was in college.
I love Faith.
Yeah. So I worked on her last six or seven pictures. And Faith, along with her husband, John Hubley, were nominated for 7 Oscars. They won 3 for animated short subject. But it's another case of where he had come out of Disney. He had worked on, you know, Snow White and Pinocchio and Bambi and Fantasia, all these big movies. And then when John died, people just assumed that he was the brain. He was everything. So it became so much more difficult for Faith to raise money. And for me, that became my graduate school working for her and understanding the situation from the get-go.
Let me also say that the numbers I'm just quoting, I mean, Amy in the film did a wonderful job at painting that statistical picture, which is so striking. Because, again, for all of the lip service about representation is going to change, the Oscars had to learn a lot of lessons in the last few years about Oscars so white. But even after Catherine Bigelow, 8 years ago, you know, where are we? Well, we have one nominee this year. And it's almost like Hollywood has this idea that, well, hey, you won something or you were the director of one big grossing film. And isn't that enough? As opposed to where a man either wins an award or becomes the director of a high grossing film. And then the door opens.
Right.
It's this weird thing where the door actually seems to close a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, as you said, obviously this is an issue that's been gotten a lot of attention in the past couple of years, but the statistics haven't changed. And at that point, you really, you know, need to confront the fact that it's not a lack of awareness, it's a lack of will. I mean, there's a lot of power, prestige, money. These people who are, you know, in charge of these big budget films, they are literally creating our culture. There is so much power in that, and people aren't very willing to share it, frankly. And people who are executives in Hollywood are very used to working a certain way with people they feel comfortable with. And it takes a lot of pushing to get that to change. And we're kind of, you know, just in the beginning of that process now. And I think there are some things to be hopeful about. This new class of people who were invited to be part of the Academy was very diverse, 49% women. And you look at the people who were on that list, incredibly talented people who we've all heard of, who deserve to be in the Academy. And I think that will definitely have an effect in the kinds of people who get nominated going forward. But I mean, just a few days ago, the DGA, the Directors Guild, released the new statistics of directors of feature films, and the numbers were still pathetic, despite the ACLU investigation, the EEOC investigation. I mean, the industry is being investigated by the federal government, and there's still no change, which just shows how entrenched this issue is.
Let me ask the other guests here if they feel any discouragement in your field because of just these realities that the film lays out.
I would say it's not so much discouragement as a lack of awareness that I'm able to do this work. So, you know, we don't see a lot of women being named as directors. In the film, you showed the, you know, Google image results for the director search term, and it's all men. And we know that there are women directors out there making movies, but that's not who we see as the image of a director. So I think showing women those pictures and saying, hey, you can do this. Again, it's not discouragement. It's a lack of knowledge that I even have that opportunity.
Tam?
Yeah, I think that for especially the numbers decrease when you talk about women in African American or mm-hmm. women of color. And I think it's so important for, you know, young people to see that they do have access to filmmaking, the film industry. And, you know, when you're in these high budget films, you want to be able to have that entrance in there because those who have, you know, who are shaping the narrative, they're able to say, you know, this is what this person can do, or this is what that person can do, or this is what this person cannot do. And I think that limits, you know, different types of people to be able to participate in this industry.
And to be able to advocate for themselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think to what you guys were both saying, I mean, visibility is so powerful. And I think that's something that is encouraging that has been changing. I mean, women have, like, there are all these, you know, female filmmaker Friday hashtag, and people just post images of themselves. Here I am working on my film set, or directing, or, you know, behind a camera, and things like that, I think, are helping. And people like Ava DuVernay, who part of her mission is you know, just showing herself at work, and she's so good on social media. And I think just seeing those images, oh, there's a woman who's an African-American woman with a huge crew behind her doing what she does, you know, those kinds of images are really powerful.
I mean, more numbers. Women of color make up 19.8% of the U.S. population. Women of color make up 0.006% of feature film directors. So you talk about a lack of representation. And let's just go ahead and let's just tackle this head on, because we're in this age of the intellectual dark web and the rise of Jordan Peterson and these ideas that men are the ones who are actually being oppressed here. So let's tackle some of this right here.
All right, wait, should we stretch first?
Amy just cracked her knuckles, leaned back, and she's ready for this. But let's do this, okay? So this is not one of the complaints is, well, if you truly level the playing field, then the James Damores of the world will say, well, you know, maybe men just want to do certain jobs and women want to do certain jobs, and there's not equal interest in fields. That's apparently not the case based on the number of men and women going into film school. And so then there is a narrowing. So then the next comment probably from this sort of movement would be, well, maybe men are just better filmmakers. Maybe that's what it's about.
I think that's been the line for a long time, and people assume that. Most people assume, I mean, I think we all have a generally positive view of how the world works, and you think it's a meritocracy because that makes us all feel better about the world we're living in, and you think the people who are good at what they do rise above.
That's based on competence, sure.
Yeah, that's a very natural, you know, assumption to make. And I think, you know, in the film, we explore all of the ways that that's not actually true, and how women, you know, people say, just get an iPhone and make a movie. Well, women are doing that day in and day out, and their films are going to Sundance, and they're going to South by Southwest, and they're going to Cannes, and they just don't get those next opportunities. Or even you have people like, you know, Catherine Hardwicke or Sam Taylor Johnson, who made Twilight or 50 Shades of Grey, these huge blockbuster films. And if a man had had that $400 million, $600 million grossing film, you better believe he'd have a full dance card of big budget movies. And those women have each struggled to just, you know, get the next project and the project after that. So there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, it's not merit-based, that certain people, you know, look like what directors have looked like for a long time, and they get those opportunities easier than women do. But I think it's very common. Most people think, well, maybe men are just better. I assume that's what it is. But I think in the film, we try to show all the different ways that, you know, women don't get the next opportunities following big successes. If they, you know, or their accomplishments get credited to their DP or their editor or some other male person has really been the one who did the work. I mean, these are things you never hear about male directors. Oh, it was really the DP, or, you know, it's, you just don't hear that.
Or sometimes, you know, Tam, it's a question of, do men who are creating a reel have better resources? I mean, imagine you're trying to get someone's attention, and the film explores this. It's easy for people to go, well, yeah, I looked at the reels and all the men's reels were better. Well, they have all the support. Yeah. They have all, and again, this is another aspect that the film explores. What goes through your mind when people say, well, I assume men are just better?
Absolutely not. I think it's all about access. I don't think it's about people being smarter. Yeah. I think if I had the access, if I had the tools and the resources and the entrance, you know, that opportunity to say, hey, you know, come on in, or you know, I'm going to give you this opportunity or this chance. I know you may not be as skilled, but we're, because I've seen your body of work, let's go in and let me, you know, let me see what you can do, but I'll also shore up your strengths as well. So I think, you know, as you were saying in the movie, of course, it's not going to be as sharp as everyone else's, but you have to give everyone an opportunity to be able to cut their teeth, because at some point in someone's career, they were new.
I think this comes up in your movie really well, and I forget who talks about it, but they were saying that they were looking at cinematography reels and, you know, really sort of daunted at first of what they were, and then realized that it was the women cinematographers had nothing, that one of them made a whole movie on a bounce card and a flashlight and, you know, talked about how they were kicking themselves to judging that, comparing them.
Yeah, and that was Nisha Ganatra, who's an incredible film and TV director. She works on Girls and Brooklyn Nine-Nine and made made a great film, Chutney Popcorn, and other films. And she talks about how she made 3 feature films and she was trying to break into TV. She did all these minority programs and women's programs, and like no one would give her that chance. She wouldn't. And finally, Jill Soloway brought her on to co-direct the first season of Transparent with Jill Soloway, and that and her, you know, career has exploded from then. But yeah, she talks about looking at DP reels, cinematographer reels, and she realizes, wait, I'm doing the same thing to these people that all those TV executives were doing to me. I didn't get the resources, I didn't get the budgets, and I had to make something with what I had, the resources I had. And you know, you can't judge that against someone who had tons of resources. But I think that, you know, access is it. It's financing, and women tend not to be in the networks where they can find and access financing. I mean, that's key to so much of it. It's harder to get their first films financed, even once they make great first films that are nominated for Academy Awards, literally, you know, Kim Pierce. And, you know, there's a long list of people with Boys Don't Cry. There's a long list of people who, or even Patty Jenkins with Monster, with Charlize Theron. Took her 9 years, 12 years to make Wonder Woman after that. I mean, she made Wonder Woman, so she's doing okay. But, you know, they make these incredible first films, and you just don't get those next opportunities. And so much of it comes down to money.
I just want to add to that, going off what Tam said, and again, also going back to self-advocacy, I think men are really used to speaking up for themselves and saying, you know, for example, I'm thinking of my time in film school getting equipment. Or now renting equipment from a gear house. You know, men are comfortable asking for crazy things, like things they don't know how to use, and they say, you know, I'll figure it out on the go. And someone trusts them to do that and to use the equipment correctly. But, you know, women have never been told that they're allowed to do that. And I mean, I would love to go to an equipment rental place and say, like, you know, give me that that red camera, give me that $100,000 lens that I've never touched before. But, you know, I would never consider doing that until I've seen other people do it and not get turned down. And then I go to do it and they're like, I don't think so. You woman.
Oh my gosh. I want to also touch on to a point that Amy Adrian was just making about this idea that even when women get the opportunity and they succeed, it's not always just this golden ticket to another job in the way that it is for men or for the way that we would assume it would be the case. And there is a really interesting concept. I brought it up on the show before, but my brain goes back to the first episode of Malcolm Gladwell's first podcast season. And it's called The Lady Vanishes, and you ought to listen to it. And it's about moral licensing. Why do we do things the way we do them when it comes to, like, how many people that you know would say, well, you know, I have a black friend, I'm not racist. It's like an insulation against a charge of racism, but they don't further explore relationships with people of color. You know, or, well, I voted for a woman once, I can't be sexist. So a lot of countries will elect a woman to be a leader one time. And that's it. Then they go back to electing men. And there's like a list of dozens of countries that have done this. And it's almost like a pat on the back. Look at us. We're not sexist. We're not racist. We've done the work. And now we can go back to being sexist or racist because we have this card that we can play. And it's called moral licensing. And I wonder if you feel that in Hollywood.
Well,
in directing, yeah.
I mean, politically, you look at, you know, when Barack Obama was president, we were in a post-racial society, apparently.
Sure. And there are people today who will say,
I voted
for Obama. How could I be a racist?
Right. I don't know. I mean, I think people tend to kind of latch on to anecdotal evidence and things that are stories and people that they're familiar with that make them seem like the situation may not be as dire as it is. So people look at Ava DuVernay and they say, well, she's directing huge movies now. She is successful. So is there really racism? Is there really sexism? But these individual, you know, exceptions to the rule do not, you know, deny the fact that systemically, I mean, as the statistic in the film says, women of color, you know, direct 0.006% of films. So you have those one or two high profile examples. And, you know, for a long time it was Catherine Bigelow. Well, she won the Oscar. So now we're over that sexism
exactly
thing, right?
Perfect example. But one statue.
Right. But there was, since then, there's been no Bigelow effect. There's been no swell of women directing those big budget films, directing action films. You know, the numbers of women being nominated for Best Director hasn't shot up. So, you know, I think that's why it's so important that these research organizations at UCLA, at USC, at San Diego State University, they look at the numbers and they say, well, you may know this person or that person who's working, but we actually study who are the people who make movies, who are the people who get hired for TV, and the numbers are terrible.
How do you feel about this idea that people like to give themselves license to behave badly by doing one ostensibly generous thing?
Yeah, it's almost worse in some ways, you know. In some ways, it really is. It's like, you know better. You know better. If you're going with that, you know better. You know, one other thing I would like to bring up, though, apart from that, is also the other gatekeepers, right? So film programmers, right, at these big festivals, like what percentage are women? I don't know. I've never seen numbers on that. Or, you know, other people that are handing out money to filmmakers, you know, specifically in documentary I'm thinking about. But I don't know about numbers on those as well. It's like, it's one thing, you know, it's a challenge to make a movie and then to get it seen is a whole other thing. If you get into Sundance, it's a lot different than, you know, other festivals perhaps for a filmmaker.
And even then, I mean, yeah, there's a whole other host of people you need to kind of get through. And we talk about some of them in the film. I mean, you take your film to Sundance and then it's probably going to be a male reviewer who's reviewing your film. And I'm sure he's good at what he does and he can, you know, try to see what you're looking to do with your film, even if it's a woman-centered story. But, you know, I can't imagine many male filmmakers would say, okay, we're going to have 75% women review your film. And, you know, they're critics and they're professionals, so you'll be fine. But there is a gender imbalance there. And then, you know, even we premiered our film at Sundance. And when you sell your film, you're looking at a table full of white male distributors. And you're saying, please like what I made. Please value it. Do you love what I made? I do. Are you connecting with it? Maybe yes, maybe no. But, you know, at every stage, whether it's critics, distributors, and people who you're asking to then put money into your film and put it out into the world, it's still very male-dominated.
Let me go ahead and let our listeners know, because I've got a couple of emails I want to read. If you want to call the program and weigh in, as we talk about sexism and barriers put up, particularly to women in filmmaking, as an email I'm about to read indicates, this is a crossing boundaries kind of conversation. This just happens to be about filmmaking today. But you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Our guests include Amy Adrian, who's director and producer of Half the Picture, which you can see tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Little Theater. It's part of the One Take documentary series, and there's a post-screening discussion with Amy. They're also showing the film Saturday at 3 p.m. if you can't get out tomorrow night for that. Linda Maroney is a filmmaker and director and programmer for the One Take Film Festival. Tam Little, Clara Riedlinger are here, both filmmakers, talking about their experiences as well. And a couple of comments here. So first from Allison. Allison emailing to say, Evan, this is not just a discussion about filmmaking. I wish it were, but I'm sure your guests already know that. I think that's probably true. Mark wants to know, though, second here, is this maybe a discussion about the kinds of movies that get made and make a lot of money? In other words, men make films where a lot of stuff blows up and people pay more money for that. Is that just a gender stereotype or is there some truth there? That's from Mark. Okay, Amy.
I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, a few years ago, the director Colin Trevorrow got in some hot water. He's the director who made an indie film called Safety Not Guaranteed that played at Sundance. I think when it was released, it made like $750,000, or that was the budget for the film. I forget, but it was a small film. And his next film following that was Jurassic World. And you don't really see women making those leaps. But he said, when he was asked about the subject, he said, well, women don't really want to make these movies. They don't want to just take on a piece of business that's like a Hollywood, you know, pay job. They make more, they have more integrity. They want to make character-driven films, and they're just, you know, they're deeper artists, and they don't really care about making these kinds of films. And he got in a lot of hot water about that because, I mean, maybe he should ask some women directors what they want to make. And certainly, statistically, we explore in the film, many women that we interviewed and that are in these studies have said they want to make sci-fi, action, they want to make big budget films. They just don't get those opportunities. So I think there's a long list of women who not only want to, but have been working very hard to be considered for those kinds of films. And you look at something like Wonder Woman, which is exactly like one. I mean, it's a superhero film. It's, you know, there's people fighting and things are exploding. But it certainly, I think, benefited from having a female director, and it had something very fresh and new about it. And she knocked it out of the park with that film. And there are many, many other women who are hustling for those opportunities. So I think that's not accurate, even though there are some women, as there are some men, who don't want to make those films. They want to make smaller films or different kinds of things. Of course, there's that diversity in what people, their ambitions. But there are a lot of really talented women who want to make big movies.
Is it possible then that there would be more men than women who would want to make a Jurassic World film, but there are plenty of women to consider, and the notion of making a blanket statement like, well, women wouldn't want to make that film, is fully exclusionary?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to just hop in there quickly and say a bunch of the women that you interviewed for the movie have made violent movies, even if they're really low budget. They're really raw, like Catherine Hardwicke, before she made Twilight, made 13, which is like a really, really intense film. And the main characters happen to be women in it. And I think women are really used to watching male violent movies, and men are maybe not primed to watch action movies or raw things like that that are made by and about women, even though they absolutely could be just as interested in that. And then there's people like Penelope Spheeris, who made Decline of Western Civilization. I think part two she did.
All of them.
She made all of them, which are like really intense rock and roll movies. Like, there's a lot of blood in those. Like, I think it's a misstatement to say that women don't make action movies already. They're just not the ones that maybe men are primed to think of as action movies because of the way that we talk about them.
And it's just so frustrating because there is that gender bias for what women can make, but not for men. I mean, men direct Bridesmaids and Spy and movies about like women's friendships and, you know, women, men direct everything and anything, because white men are the kind of the baseline and they can do anything. Whereas women, it's, you know, when Kimberly Pierce made Stop Loss, which was a film about the Iraq War, it's like, well, why are you making this film? Can you make it? Do you think you can make it? And, you know, women face those kinds of genre barriers that men really don't. I mean, they make any story about any woman or about people of color or about LGBTQ, even if they're not from that community. And it's just assumed that because you're an artist, you can do it. And women are rarely given that liberty.
And I don't know if I want to. Okay, I'm just going to say this, but whatever risk to
say
myself.
It. Go for it.
Do it.
We had John Landis on the show on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And I had never seen Animal House until last Thursday night. And one of my first takeaways was, well, of course a man made this film, because, look, as having never been a woman and never been in a sorority, I don't know if this is true, but I just don't know how many naked pillow fights happen, you know, with a dozen nude women pillow fighting, giggling, so all the men can look in the windows. Of course a man made that movie, and of course there are consequences to huge budget films in which the objectification, I'm sorry. Anyway.
I feel like I just need to throw in here that my parents took me to see Animal House at a drive-in theater when I was about 5 years old.
Whoa.
So, Mom and Dad, if you're listening, I'm letting the world know. And that's a great movie. I mean, the thing is that I just don't want to get lost in this conversation is not that men need to tailor all of their stories and experiences because of other people might get insulted. It's like women just need those opportunities too, to make what they want to make and fully explore what they're interested in. And like, men have had that opportunity and that liberty and women haven't. So I think men get very nervous because they think, oh, well, I'm being hemmed in with what I can do. And Steven Spielberg got a lot of criticism a few years ago, saying that he didn't make enough films that feature women's stories. And he has made some, The Color Purple and a couple that really have. But I think, you know, I think people should make films about what they're passionate about, and they should be able to do that. But there should be female Steven Spielbergs and Martin Scorsese's who have those same opportunities and those same resources so they can make what they're passionate about, you know?
Yeah. Tam, you want to add to the concerns about being pigeonholed or the range that women are not afforded the way men are?
Yeah, I think this is why we're here, because they are being pigeonholed. Women are being pigeonholed. And as we said before, it's really about the narrative and how we're, you know, film is very powerful. What you see visually is very powerful, and it shapes how we see people and what we think about people. And as I said before, what they can and can't do. So it's just so important, as we said, you know, as we keep saying, just give folks, you know, the opportunity to be able to, you know, be as creative. You know, women, I think women can do anything. We're birthing babies, for God's sake. So we're doing all these things. And I think that's another thing, you know, just people are thinking, oh, just because you're a mother, of two or three, that you can't do it. So it's so important that we look beyond that. You know, we're raising families, children, you know, we're doing working at the same time. So there's nothing that we can't do. And I think as more women begin to show that you can bring home the bacon too and fry it up in a pan and create a movie as well, and it be, you know, being done very well, that will give other young women the opportunity to see, I can do this as well.
All right, so let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back with our guests, there's a lot more to talk about. I want to ask Amy Adrian if she thinks just raising this conversation more often is going to help start chip away at these numbers, or if it's going to take something more overt. What is going to move the needle in Hollywood, in directing, in opportunities for women when it comes to making films? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about inclusion riders. Frances McDormand, of course, raised that. I mean, a very interesting idea on how to more sort of intentionally change the dynamics, and some other things as well. And listeners, I know if some of you are going to say, I mean, you have no sense of humor about Animal House. That's fine. You can bring it. You can email me. We'll take it to email. I had a nice chat with John Landis on Friday, and that's okay. You can bring it. But we'll come right back and continue the conversation here. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, when we talk about urbanism, we're talking about walkability, connected neighborhoods, but this movement is not just here in the United States. What does it look like in other countries, in some of the most congested cities in the world? We'll meet two people who have been there. Then in our second hour, the World Cup has four semifinalists, and you will meet expats here in Rochester celebrating their squads on in the World Cup. So welcome back to Connections. I think you ought to go tomorrow night to Half the Picture, if you can. Find out now, right? Linda Moroney, where can people find out if there's even tickets still available to tomorrow night's 7 p.m. screening?
Thelittle.org. So there's a page there for Half the Picture, and you can buy tickets for either day, but I haven't checked to see. And Amy has a lot of family in the area,
yeah.
So they may have bought up the bulk of the seats by now at this point.
I heard from some of them already on Twitter. They're very excited. But check out now. Check it out now. 7 p.m. tomorrow night. It includes a post-screening discussion with Amy. You can also go Saturday at 3 p.m. to see the film. What's the best case scenario that a film like this engenders what? It creates what kind of movement? What's realistic in your mind, Amy?
Well, I think a couple things. I think that, you know, my great hope is that people in the industry who are the gatekeepers, who do, you know, the way that they work really influences who gets those opportunities. I hope that those people see the film. And I know for a fact that at least some of them have. I mean, the film played at Sundance and at South by Southwest, and really major, major agents from WME and CAA have seen the film, and major film festival programmers have seen the film. And I've had both agents and festival programmers and producers say to me, seeing your film has affected how we approach programming our festival this year, or seeing your film has made me think about how we're dealing with lists internally in the office for different, you know, hiring opportunities. You know, we'll see how much of that, you know, what kind of effect that is. But I think, you know, you want the people who are actually working in the business to be aware of these issues. And I think, you know, the goal of the film, certainly you mentioned there are statistics in the film that I think paint a pretty full picture of the problem as it exists. But I would say also that I don't want to get lost in the conversation. The film is also, it centers these incredible artists, these incredible women who've made fantastic films despite all of these challenges, despite at every step of the way having things be harder than it's been for men. They've still made incredible films. And the film is really a celebration of their perseverance, of their artistry, of their work. And I think that, you know, my second hope for the film is that all different kinds of people see the film and are inspired to make their own work. They see, okay, the system wasn't built for I'm a woman or I'm a person of color or LGBTQ or, you know, this isn't an industry that has been traditionally open to people like me, but look at all these women in the film and look what they've made and look what they've done. So if they can do it, I can do it too. So that's kind of the second and greater hope for the film, that people just leave inspired. And I've had that experience too. After every screening, people say, I have this screenplay that I've been working on for years, or I have this short, or I have this doc project. And they'll tweet it or put it on Instagram and like, I'm going to go home and work on it now. And you're like, that's the greatest compliment that I could ever get. And I think, you know, yes, the film explores challenges and all that's wrong in the business, but it's not a bummer of a film, and it's inspiring. And to see these incredible women, I think people do leave kind of on fire to tell their own stories. And that's really exciting.
Should be super inspiring. People should be going, wow, how have I not seen this work? I want to find this work. I want to go see it. I want to see more films made by the people in the film. I want to bring in producer Megan Mack behind the glass, and I asked her to grab the microphone. I know she's okay with talking about this. This is not going out of bounds here. Let's just be blunt about it, because I'm thinking about the email we got from Allison earlier this hour, where she said, Evan, your guests probably know that this is a conversation that goes beyond filmmaking. And of course it is. And I started thinking about the way that some people in this community, some guests of this program, interact with Megan and me differently. We are equal partners on the show. I happen to be the one sitting with the microphone most days, though many times when I'm not here, Megan is hosting the show. But we're equal partners of a show, equal parts of the show's brain, and equal parts of the creativity and the creation of it. And yet, how often, Megan, do people think, oh, are you Evan's assistant or secretary or the language they use? I mean, it happens all the time, right?
That happens many times every week, more often than I'd like. I don't want it to happen at all. And sometimes I think maybe people just don't understand what a producer does. But I think that's being euphemistic. But the question I have for the guests is, sometimes guests will come in, and I won't name names, but I'll sit them down, I'll offer them water, and they'll say, thanks, honey, thanks, sweetheart. And I think, what is this, Leave It to Beaver and I'm June Cleaver? No, why would you? And I don't want to generalize, but I doubt that they would say that if there was a male producer coming in, right? So I want to know how all of you would address that, because in your film, Amy, one of the directors says, be overt about it. Call that person out in public. I don't know if you all think that's a little too brash, or what's the best approach to handle things like that so it stops happening for all of us or anyone else, any other woman in any field who's being called honey or sweetheart or any term like that.
Well, I think I would just say in the film, Ava DuVernay has a story about that, but it's more about being like blatantly disrespected on set and having crew members like literally tell a joke about her where she's the butt of the joke. And she was like, I can't let that slide because I will lose the respect of the crew. And she, some of the filmmakers in the film, and it's not in the film, but some of the women we interviewed said, oh, you can never call them out in public. That will embarrass people. You need to pull them aside. But we didn't include those stories. We included Ava saying, you need to call them out in public, because I was like, I feel like that's what needs to happen, because then the whole crew sees it's not acceptable. But I think what you're talking about is trickier, because it's disrespectful, but people doing it in a way that they would probably say, I thought I was being
friendly
or sweet or complimentary or... And all that stuff is really tricky.
It's all those microaggressions that people aren't even thinking that they're being aggressive about, but are coming across that way.
And some of it's culture. It's just maybe they've been, I mean, I'm assuming these are older guys. Maybe they're not. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, maybe they've been saying that to women for the past 40 years. So it's hard to get people to think differently about that. And they do think they're being sweet. But I don't know. Do you guys have a good answer? Because you don't want to be like...
I mean,
I don't know.
I've had that happen to me often. I'm thinking of my current full-time job. I have people emailing me all the time asking who the audio expert in the office is, and I'm like, it's me. I'll fix your audio. You're emailing her right now. Yeah. And you know, so things like that, people just don't realize, and I think it's really important to step in and tell them.
Yeah.
You know, hey, I'm sorry. Please don't call me that. Or, you know, so if it's warranted, say, you know, that's inappropriate. Don't speak to me that way. And to just tell them, because they really might not know. And if they get defensive, they get defensive, and that's on them. It's not your responsibility to comfort them.
Right. I mean, it is complicated. I mean, I feel for you, because it's like, these are guests who are going to come sit on this program. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to like throw them off and be like, that's inappropriate, sir. Like, get to, you know, you're in 2018, sure. And then they're going to be on the show and be like, wait, what just happened?
I would say only if so it's warranted. So, right. Yeah, for sure.
I know.
Yeah.
Maybe you can just say, you're welcome, sugar.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Yeah. I've been looking for a good response. There right. It was all along.
Yeah. You know, it's so a little bit different with me, but I'll just answer your question. I think, too, just what I've had to do is just let them know who I am up front. And yeah. And it's unfortunate that you have to, you know, put your ABCs behind your name in order to be validated. And so I think sometimes when you introduce yourself to people, you have to let them know what you do. I've had people just to say, you know, just for me as a woman of color, just to call me girl or just things like that, just very, you know, just subtly and just being a little bit of, you know, passive aggressive towards me. So I think it's really just confronted as subtly, but I think getting in front of a lot of things ahead of time and just letting them know, you know, I'm the producer. And when I was making my documentary, everyone thought that my husband made the film. So they were like, oh, did you help him out? I said, no, he just helped me edit it. And I was there along the way. I did everything. I posted, you know, I did everything, essentially. And so they were like, oh, you know, so they can't believe it. So when they see me, it's more of a like a, they have to, they have sort of a paradigm shift. And I think it's good. And I don't, you know, you don't want to make people uncomfortable. But I think it's important that you begin changing their minds about things so that they, you know, the next scenario that they're in, their situation that they're in, they know how to interact appropriately with those people and not assume just because that's the way it's been.
Yeah.
It's, I was going to try to be optimistic and say it's not every day. It feels like it's a lot of days that happens. Fair?
More often than I'd like, yes.
Yeah.
Do you invite those guests back?
Usually.
Ah, interesting.
There was a gentleman one time who, after Megan left the studio, he turned to me and said, she's such a sweet girl. And I said, she's a hardworking woman.
Yes.
You know.
I will say that never happens when I fill in for you when you're gone. It only happens when I am producing.
I mean,
It doesn't happen when I'm hosting, so...
I would guess you're right that even just saying, can I get you a water or something, people assume that you're just there to make them feel comfortable and there's some kind of mental, you know, I can treat this person this way as opposed to sitting at the microphone. I mean, neither is appropriate, but yeah.
But
there's a lot culturally to work through, and hopefully having these conversations will make people aware of it.
Yeah, and it's not, and I take Megan's point of when she's hosting the show, it may be different. But if you hosted the show 365 days a year, I suspect there'd still be gendered comments because I think it's mostly about gender. And it's a bummer. But on that note, I mean, the film tackles this idea of the, quote, the irrational fear of the female director. So, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, well, some of these interactions are a relic of how men used to think about women and women's capabilities and all of these things. But I'd like to ask you I'll go around the table. I'll start with you, Claire. I mean, do men, generally speaking, interact differently if it's a woman who is directing? Do they look to take that woman down a bit? Is there a different dynamic or a fear?
I would describe the fear in almost a broader sense. I think a lot of men feel that when women say, hey, we want more directing jobs, we want more producing jobs, we want more opportunities, men fear that we are trying to take something away from them, that we're trying to step in and steal their jobs or their spots at the table. But that's not what we're asking at all. We want the table to be longer and have more seats at it that can fit women and people of color and queer people, you know, so it's not necessarily a sense of fear created on set or in a meeting. It's this more generalized anxiety of losing some privilege.
You're coming for our jobs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Power protects power. Sure. And it assumes it's zero sum instead of the table just getting larger for everyone. Linda?
Unfortunately, I've seen, you know, not in quite a long time, but previously where women do break through and they've elbowed their way to get to a certain position and they feel that there's only one or two spaces for them to be and they don't want other people to come up with them. I don't see that necessarily as much as I used used to, but I've definitely experienced that as well. As far as fear, I think there's more of an assumption. Like, you know, I've worked as a producer, I've worked as a director, and I think sometimes I think, oh, well, maybe she doesn't know how the camera works or what frame rates are or things like that. And there's this assumption that because I'm a woman, I just don't know the technical stuff. So that's always fun.
I've experienced that.
How do you deal with that, by the way?
Usually I yell and fire people.
Do you really?
No. Well, it depends. I mean, it depends on the situation. You know, there was times when I worked on, I was in India on a film shoot with a crew, and there was all sorts of cultural stuff going on, you know. So it depends on the situation and what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Tam? I'm sorry, go ahead, Claire.
I just wanted to add to that quickly, specifically with men thinking that we don't know how cameras work or we don't know what frame rates are. You know, my response to that is always just to interrupt them, which is a thing that happens a lot to women that men do. They interrupt us. So I interrupt them and I say, I know how it works. Thank you for trying to explain to me, but I know how it works.
Yeah. Like you said before, I think it's not always... I think fear is a part of it, but I think it's about assumptions as well. So I think as women, we do have to work a little bit harder, a little bit longer, and it's really about proving yourself to people, and they can see, you know, your body of work, and you have to give them an opportunity to also see what you can do. And I think it's progressive. I think that, you know, the more you talk about it, the more people's minds will change.
Amy, when it comes to equal opportunity, one of the corners of our public sphere that's pushing back a little on conversations like this is implying that, well, you all want to force equal outcomes. I don't hear that, though. I think that's a straw man argument. I think asking for equal opportunity is not the same as saying we will only rest when there's 50% and 50%, or equal amount X. I don't hear that necessarily. Do you?
Right. No. And I think that's, I mean, I feel like that's a phrase and an approach that's been used in many different spheres regarding many different kinds of discrimination. And women and people who have been outside of the system are asking for the opportunities that they rightly deserve. Hollywood is always going to be a place where there are fewer directing jobs than there are people who want to be directors, period. It is an incredibly competitive place. It's really hard to get those jobs. And, you know, women who are qualified and talented and who have made work are asking to be considered in the way that they should appropriately be considered. You know, they're not asking for things that are out of the realm of possibility. But again, you just have to kind of look at the numbers and look at the statistics that men have historically done a certain amount of work, and then they get these following opportunities. And that doesn't happen for women. And I would say, just to go back to your, you know, conversation about fear of women directors, I think it's just, there's always a sense that a woman director, no matter who she is, no matter if it's Catherine Hardwicke, who's directed 15 films, or, you know, Catherine Bigelow, a woman is always a risk. There's always a perceived sense of risk in hiring a woman. And that is just something that we need to get over, because people have bodies of work, they have qualifications, they have experience. And that's just like a cultural thing that people need to get over, that women are inherently a risk despite their experience.
Sure. The 10 biggest bombs of the last year were probably all directed by men, because all the movies are directed by men. So,
And that's fear. I mean, that goes into another whole conversation of, like, they're men, you know, some movies hit, some meet expectations, and some fail. That's what happens in the business. And whenever a woman has anything that's not seen as a home run, it's like, well, you know, it's the standards are quite different.
Yeah, the door's going to close. John and Henrietta, if you can keep it to 30 seconds or less, go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to add, for me, the sad note is that we have people among us who are confirmed sexist and confirmed racist, and no amount of truth is going to correct that. Just something might change it for them, but I haven't been seeing it, and it's a little bit discouraging. That's my comment. Mm.
John, thanks for the phone call. That may be a little... cynical is probably not the right word, just pessimistic on the rate of change and what happened. So, Linda, I'll ask you what I asked Amy. What do you think could come out of a film like this that's showing tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the Little Theater, Saturday at 3 p.m.?
You're really good at that.
I am. You don't have to do it. That's why
I know,
you come out here.
Perfect.
You're the host.
This is wonderful.
That's right.
I really hope it inspires more filmmakers to tell their story. You know, we don't want to see the same movies over and over. We want different viewpoints. We want different experiences. We don't want to eat the same thing for dinner every night. So hopefully it'll inspire more women filmmakers, or, you know, more filmmakers of every kind to take a chance and start making work. And hopefully the doors will open up at the higher levels for more people to come through those doors.
And then, Amy, 30 seconds. We've had some comments from listeners about the roles of women. So in other words, their assumption is you have women directors. You won't just have women as, you know, sexual objects or damsels in distress, just sort of the wife, the girlfriend, right. More interesting roles. Yeah?
Yeah. No, I think that's so true. I mean, part of the conversation that's hard is people don't really understand what a director does, but a director casts a film. They choose how someone is, the angles that someone is shot. They choose the music and the editing and who's highlighted and who's the hero and who's sidelined and who are the helpers. And when more women are making those films, women's stories can be more centered, and that's good for all of us.
Amy Adrian's film is Half the Picture. Tomorrow night, 7 p.m., including a conversation after that film. Amy will be here for that. Saturday, 3 p.m., thelittle.org. Check out all the information there. Get tickets now. Don't wait. It's always smarter. And yeah, I'm happy to let people know Linda Moroney. Linda Moroney is the filmmaker and director and programmer for the One Take Film Festival. Always nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Amy Adrian, thanks for coming in and telling us about Half the Picture.
Thank
you.
The
work you're doing. Appreciate that. Tam Little and Clara Riedlinger, we will be looking for your films and future conversations with both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, an equal parts powerhouse of this program. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Connections.